It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. Brianna Wu is here. She's got a big announcement. We'll also talk to Mike Elgin, Dwight Silverman. Giphy, or is it Giphy, sold for a huge amount of money to Facebook. Why is the U.S. government about to sue Google for monopolizing online ads? What Apple's AR glasses might look at, and then a close-up look at Unreal Engine 5. It's all coming up next on Twit. This Week in Tech comes to you from Twit's LastPass Studios. You're focused on security, but are your employees? LastPass can ensure they are by making access and authentication seamless, whether they're working in the office or remotely. Visit LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 771, recorded Sunday, May 17th, 2020. Ferment all the things. This episode of This Week in Tech is brought to you by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Thinking about moving your data storage to the cloud? Wasabi is enterprise-class cloud storage at one-fifth the price of Amazon S3 and faster than the competition, with no fees for egress or API requests and no complex storage tiers. Start a free trial at wasabi.com. Enter the offer code TWIT. And by ZipRecruiter. During this time of change, ZipRecruiter's focus hasn't changed. They're still doing what they've always done, helping people find work and helping businesses find the right people for their open roles. Go to ziprecruiter.com/worktogether. And by LinkedIn Learning. A lot of things are changing in our professional lives. With over 16,000 courses taught by industry experts, LinkedIn Learning is where you can get skills like how to master working from home, entrepreneurship foundations, or how to be a resilient leader. Try 1 month free at linkedinlearning.com/twit. And by ExtraHop, the cybersecurity company that helps modern enterprises protect their business and keep critical systems available with cloud-native threat detection and response. Check out the full product demo and more at extrahop.com/twit. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, show where we cover the week's tech news. Dwight Silverman joining us, the tech burger himself. Actually, you're on HoustonChronicle.com/techburger, B-U-R-G-E-R. But then I think of you as a burger, B-U-R-G-H-E-R, like the mayor of the town of Tech Burger.
So you think I should add a redirect for Tech Burger with an H, Leo?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Hey, Dwight, in the Houston Chronicle building for the first time in months.
Yeah, definitely.
Is it quiet?
It is very quiet. We've been away since March. Been working at home since then. It is really, I like working at home normally. I don't like working at home under these conditions.
Yeah.
But it's really good to be back, and it's pretty empty here because everybody is working from home. Copy editors and folks who lay out the print edition.
What we do as bloggers and as podcasters can be done at home, but I always think of a newspaper as a big room with people yelling and running around and banging on typewriters. And then, of course, in fact, Jeff Jarvis tells a story of he was there to computerize, I think it was the Examiner, because they still had typewriters, and they brought in whatever the first computer system was. But even then, you couldn't go home and do it. You had to come in.
Right. And we do, you know, our business work in the business news section. We have weekly Zoom conferences.
Do you file like a Word document and then the typesetters get it, or?
No. We use a content management system called CCI. It's based out of Europe for print. And then we have our own proprietary software for doing web stuff. And so everything is just done kind of in this one thing. And you can do it from anywhere.
Anywhere.
I mean, it helps to be able to collaborate. But even, like I said, even the people who are doing page layout are able to do
that. That's one of the things that's really changed. And this quarantine would be a very different experience. But so many businesses that traditionally, you know, have to be performed on site, like a newspaper, not anymore.
Right. And but, for, you know, one of the things about the Houston Chronicle is we have been through enough hurricanes that we know how to kind of do this. It's just like a permanent ongoing hurricane.
Yeah. We were a little better prepared because of the fires in Sonoma County last couple of years. Mike Elgin is also here. He's grounded for the time being. Our gastro nomad stuck at home. At least you kept the chef with you.
Yes, absolutely. And yeah, my wife has been cooking up a storm, and it's been actually great. So we've been, in order to keep myself from gaining weight, we've been doing massive hiking. So lots of eating and lots of hiking.
So you had gastronomad experiences planned at gastronomad.net.
Yes.
Are they just all called off, or?
We postponed two or three of them. So Provence has now been booted to next year. The one that was already scheduled for next year is still on. So we're going to do two Provence experiences next year. We're still shooting for a couple of European experiences this year, later in the year. And, you know, they're opening Italy on June 1st. And so
that doesn't sound like a great idea, to be honest with you, but okay. I'm not sure I'd rush en masse to Italy right now.
Well, the place where we do the experience is actually a farmhouse on a mountain. The nearest neighbor is about a half a mile away, and the second nearest neighbor is like 3 miles away. And then we go to people's homes. So we go to, instead of going to a winery and a tasting room, we'll go to the winemaker's house and do tasting at her house and that sort of thing. So we are, it's a, most of our, some of our experiences, especially the European ones, Provence and Italy, they're already kind of socially distancing oriented already. So I think we can, do it. Plus people are dying to travel. So
yeah.
I think it'll happen, you know.
I know you won't do it if it's not safe, but it sounds like it's possible. I do fantasize about like moving my quarantine, just picking it up and putting it somewhere. Right. So maybe that's what you offer, an alternative space to quarantine.
Exactly.
Also joining us, Brianna Wu.
Hello.
So now we're going to have to change your lower third.
Yeah, I guess we are.
I got a depressing email from you last week. You've decided to call off your campaign.
I did. You know, I'm running against an incumbent, and it's just not possible to beat someone that's been there for as long as Stephen Lynch has been there. If you can't knock on doors, if you can't hold events, if you can't give speeches. One of the things with digital is you're essentially talking to people that already support you if you're holding digital events. So I just didn't feel good about, you know, using my, you know, my supporters' money to support something that I didn't feel I had a mathematical chance of winning. So it was the hardest thing I've ever done. It's hard throwing away 3 years of work because we had all the other pieces of the campaign in place. We had a killer field team, but, you know, it's just this coronavirus. I could not ethically put my team in a position where they were risking their lives.
Yeah, rightly so. I understand. Yeah. It's, you know, we got a challenge in general because we got a big election coming up in November and it's going to be.
Yeah.
What happened to the primaries? Are they all just canceled or?
Pretty much, yeah.
We were like in the middle of this gung-ho primary season and they just flatlined.
Just over.
Pause.
Well, it's kind of a relief, isn't it? I mean, how many more debates can we handle?
I know.
Yeah.
I'm all debated out.
Yeah. could have actually stopped about five debates earlier, if you ask me. But yeah. Okay. The tech industry does not slow down. I thought when we started sheltering in place 2 months ago, oh boy, you know, I don't know what it's going to look like in 2 months. There'll be no stories. But you know what? The tech industry seems to be going gung-ho. For instance, this week, Facebook announced it's buying... Is it Jiffy? I still don't know.
Jiffy.
It's Jiffy. I'm calling it Yeefy. Do you mind if I call it Yeefy?
Yeefy.
It sounds like we're all having seizures. I think Jiffy would call it Jiffy. Because Giphy actually ran a series of, I don't know, promotions or something a while ago where they basically said it's the GIF that keeps on giving. They were doing puns like that, which indicated that they use a hard G, but that's just one data point. I don't think this will ever be resolved. In the meantime,
I feel like if you're going to spell your company name G-I-P-H-Y, you're asking to be called Jiffy.
Yes. Yes.
Wouldn't you spell it J-I-F-F-Y?
No, because no, it's a pun. It's a play on a GIF, but it's a GIF. Oh, I don't know. Anyway, so you think the company calls it Giphy?
I do.
That's such a terrible name. I'm glad they got sold.
Well, now they call it Facebook.
Yeah, so it's interesting because does Giphy have any way of monetizing? I mean, they're everywhere. They're on Twitter. They're on Slack. They're, of course, on Facebook. About half the traffic, according to Axios, for Giphy comes from people using Facebook, searching for animated GIFs and then using Giphy to put them into their messages. That's the primary use for it. I suppose they might make a little money selling special GIFs when the next Star Wars comes out, something like that. But it really is, there's no ads in Giphy, is there?
I think there are ads.
Yeah.
I think
are
if you
there?
Go to the site, I think there are.
On the site, but no.
Oh,
who
yeah,
sees
on the site when you create it. But yeah. Who creates the content?
No. I mean, it's 90% of, I guess 99% of the users are just doing it in the keyboard.
Yeah.
And, you know, even Apple's messages, you type, you know, you search for GIFs and that's GIFs. That's what you're going to get. So
that's where you're going to jet.
So, and by the way, very popular. They said that they have 300 million daily active users. So it's a lot of people use it. They must have huge expenses. Why then is it worth, get ready, $400 million to Facebook?
Well, here's one thing to consider. When you are sharing GIFs and or GIFs on Twitter, on Tumblr, on anywhere, you will now be sharing a little piece of Facebook,
Facebook, going everywhere.
And it's kind of like Facebook getting their claws into all the other social networks, because if you know most of the GIFs shared these days are shared on messaging platform. They're shared on Facebook or its competitors.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a I don't know what exactly how they're going to monetize it from a dollar and cents point of view, but it is a power play. It basically makes Facebook really ubiquitous.
I think it also tells you how valuable data is. That really, yes. You don't need to monetize, because what you're getting is now you know what Twitter users are doing, what Apple Messages users are doing, what Slack users are doing. You have all sorts of additional information. And I don't know how much the Giphy keyboard gives Facebook when you use it, but I'm going to guess it gives you them more than just what GIF you searched for.
And also, you know, they actually came in under their latest valuation. They just did a funding round that valued them at $600
million.
Wow. So Facebook actually got a bargain.
A bargain. A half billion dollar bargain.
It also comes.
I mean, but look at it this way. It's. I definitely agree. Privacy and data has got to be part of it. But it's just a feature. I mean, whenever I'm forced to use Facebook, this is a method of communication that it's a great way to leave a fun comment or a sarcastic.
Oh,
response.
I love it, and I think everybody loves it. In fact, it's the bane of Slack. I actually had to yell at my team and say, stop putting animated GIFs in the freaking general channel. I can't keep track of what's going on. GIF channel just for it. You have to have a channel just for the humorous fun.
Yeah, definitely. No, but I mean, this way they can, they can go through, they can put their moderation policies in place, make sure there's not stuff coming up that's, inappropriate for different channels. So I think in addition to the data, it's a feature. It's like when Apple tried to buy Dropbox, it's just something as part of it. Facebook can certainly drop this money. It's a no-brainer, really.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'm just trying to make it be scary and spooky. That's going to be part of, it's going to be part of Instagram, and it's a quarter of all traffic to Giphy goes through Instagram. So it's very popular, but it's not a unique feature. And I doubt that. Here's how you'll know if Facebook says, oh no, it's unique. We own it. You can only use it on Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp. Then you're right, Brianna. It's a feature that's so valuable they're willing to spend $400 million because people love it, and they're taking it away from Twitter and Slack and Apple and everybody else. But my guess is they won't. My guess is they'll make it even more available to more people. That costs them money.
Yeah.
That's a lot of data. That's a lot of servers. But it's also inbound data. And I wonder, it's kind of hard to figure out, but how much, what do they get, location information? Do they get, what do they get if you're using
Well, here's one Giphy. Thing they get. So one thing to consider is the fact that one quarter of Giphy's traffic, you can't say it without being self-conscious.
Giphy, I know, Giphy. I hate this. I hate it. Rename it
Facebook. One quarter of the usage of their service is actually on Instagram. So by buying it, Facebook is making sure nobody else buys it. So yeah, Instagram is currently heavily reliant on this service. Right. And so they figure, well, let's just own it so that we don't have problems.
I bet it's used on Snap, which is, Facebook and Instagram are their arch rival. There's another service, but I mean, Giphy is the main service that does this, right? Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, Mike, that's such a good point too, because the thing is, I'm not a fair use lawyer, but imagine if someone else bought this and cut off Facebook and Instagram's access to it. They couldn't really go through and pull up all those movies and stuff as a giant company to recreate this data set very easily, because it's user-generated content. So I would imagine, I mean, it's not like Apple Maps where, you know, they can go create their own thing. I think it's uniquely valuable in that way.
According to the Medium post from the Giphy company, their API will not go away. Giphy's GIFs, stickers, emojis aren't going anywhere. We'll continue to make Giphy openly available to the wider ecosystem. So, I mean, of course, you know, the acquisitions, people always say stuff like that. But, I'm going to guess this is valuable to Facebook over and above the value that of simply putting funny dancing bears in your messages. It seems to me often the case in technology that the silliest stuff is actually the most nefarious. You know, the dark patterns show up as dancing bears more often than not.
Right.
Maybe that's just me looking for a story. I don't know. Facebook is launching Brianna, you were talking about creating you absolutely should. And I want you to encourage you to do this. So maybe a political action committee on tech issues, since that's your expertise. Facebook is setting up what the Washington Post calls a dark money group, advocacy group in Washington called American Edge. Maybe they call it dark money because, as you know, Washington Post's motto is democracy dies in darkness.
Yeah.
It's a nonprofit. It's the setup allows it to navigate a thicket of tax laws in such a way it can raise money and blitz the airwave with ads without the obligation of, and this is why it's dark money, disclosing its donors. The NRA does the same thing, as an example. American Edge has a good name. It's like, let's keep our edge. Let's keep innovation. And it comes at a perfect time because, now, and I read this story and I thought, well, that's the Washington Post, Rupert Murdoch's journal, going after Google. But the Post had a big article that the U.S. government is getting ready to sue Google. Justice Department state attorneys general likely to bring antitrust lawsuits against Google, focused on the ad business. There's no love lost between the Wall Street Journal and Google. We know that. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton and some other attorneys general are likely to file a case probably in the fall, people familiar with the matter said, focused on Google's online ad business. It's funny because we had a little hiatus in the anti-tech, you know, the tech lash, because without tech, this quarantine would be a little bit tougher for everybody. But now it's coming back. Or maybe it's just the Wall Street Journal trying to gin up some anti-tech sentiment.
I think the New York Times also had had its own separate report.
Did they? Okay.
Well, yeah, it's typical. Ken Paxton, who's the Texas Attorney General, who, by the way, remains under indictment, jumps into a lot of these. He was early on in the state attorney's general lawsuit to try to block the T-Mobile Sprint merger. And he settled with them relatively early. He kind of pulled out of it after a while. It'd be interesting to see, if there's something that Google would do for Texas or for him, have him settling quickly.
Wall Street Journal says that Attorney General William Barr has devoted considerable resources to the Google probe, continues to treat it as a top priority. They have a quote from him that says, the Justice Department will make a final call this summer. I'm hoping that we bring it to fruition early summer, Mr. Barr said. And by fruition, I mean decision time.
Well, does anybody worry that this is just purely political?
The tweet yesterday from the president?
The most chilling tweet ever from President Trump. He said that yes, the Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, are run by far left people, and we're going to do something about it. I'm paraphrasing. And so that is not good for the president to be saying that.
I've long ago blocked his account, so let me see if I can find it. But it was a scary thing. Because it sounded like he was saying we're going after them because they're propaganda for the left.
Well, I think that's what's so frustrating about this, right? Because I think all of us would agree we want regulatory oversight of Google's ad business. It's a fact that they've paid some of the largest fines in history in Europe. It's a fact that they've moved into anti-competitive behavior on many occasions. And, you know, even with Facebook, it doesn't surprise me that they are putting out, you know, something to formally advocate for themselves and to push Congress the way that they would want Congress to move. It's just so frustrating because we need that kind of oversight from the Justice Department. But because you have a president that's talking about it in such partisan terms, it really politicizes the Justice Department, and it becomes not about protecting people from what's effectively an advertising duopoly. It becomes just another partisan screaming match, and that's what's so disappointing about it.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I think we'd all agree that it's a conversation that has to happen. I mean, tech has gotten very big, and there's some serious and legitimate concerns.
Yeah.
It's not that we're saying, oh, no, it's wonderful and it's perfect, but it is a little. Why did you find it chilling, Michael?
Well, he basically said that, first of all, he characterized the owners, like he's zeroing in on the individual people who own the services and saying that their politics is far left.
Interesting.
And indicated that he's going to do something about it. So that's a lot of posturing. He's doing a lot of posturing lately. But essentially, in political science, a conservative Republican is in favor of minimizing government meddling with businesses. In a fascist dictatorship, the dictator is interested in using the government to go after the people who own sources of content that disagree with his politics. That's the difference between a conservative and a fascist. Yeah. That's one of the differences. And so his statement, his tweet, taken just by itself, is the statement of a fascist dictator. Now, this may appeal to part of his base. And he may just have been in meetings where they're talking about they're going to have antitrust effort against some of the tech companies. And then he was responding to Michelle Malkin, I believe it was, who was talking about the leftist leanings of social media owners. And he was replying to that and saying, yeah, we're going to do something about that. So who knows? You can't trust anything this guy tweets, obviously. Yeah. But taken on its face, it was just a horrifying thing to say for a president.
But so much of what he says is bluster, and so much of what he says is posturing and playing to a base. You don't know if any of that would ever come to fruition. I agree with you that it's kind of a horrifying statement on its face until you look at who's actually saying it and how often he says things like that don't, you know, amount to much other than to rile his base. You know, every time there have been serious hearings on tech issues, a lot of the Republicans try to hijack them with discussions of unfairness and social media.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just that it's a hijack. It's not a real issue. And, but it's something that they could use to get the base going, and they've got a base to get to the polls in November.
But Dwight, I'd love to add on to that. You know, this stuff is, it's not just bluster. There was another story that came out this week that Google nuked their inclusion and diversity programs because they were afraid of these exact kind of characterizations from the conservative movement in this country.
That to say I'm pro-diversity, right, would brand you as a radical leftist.
Exactly. And, you know, I have worked with a lot of the people at Google. They've done the unconscious bias training. It's excellent. It's really good stuff. For me, it's stuff that made me consider some of my actions, because people don't know this. Women have it's just a 2% difference in unconscious bias against other women as men do. So, you know, this stuff, it's not just bluster. It's work in the refs. It's
I like
it
that.
Reframes
work in the refs. I agree with that phrase.
Yeah. I love it.
Good phrase.
Yeah.
So, it's so not just mine. To be very specific about this tweet we've been talking about, specifically he wrote, "The radical left is in total command and control of Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Google. The administration is working to remedy this illegal situation. Stay tuned," et cetera.
Yeah.
So he's saying that for people to be in charge of Facebook whose politics are leftist is illegal. That's what he asserted. Right. It's illegal to be left-leaning and own a company like Facebook, course, Instagram, Twitter, or Google.
Where did he announce it? On Twitter.
Exactly.
Right.
It's very confusing. I'm confused. I'm very confused.
Twitter, which will not block him.
Yeah.
Even when his tweets can be incitement to violence.
Right. Or where he tweets something that, you know, they would block if anybody else said it because it's scientifically unfactual about the COVID virus. But he is the president. And so I understand their point of view there that, well, you know, he's the president. So you gotta let him tweet. It's ironic.
Well, they should do to him what Facebook has done to me. So for many, many years while I was still using Facebook and Instagram, I was a harsh critic of Facebook. And I ended up, no doubt, on some list that basically said none of my stuff is going to be widely distributed or can go viral. So my Facebook posts, my Instagram posts, just everything lands with a thud because I am part of this. They had this whole group that was there to prevent fake news and terrorist content and all this other objectionable stuff from going viral at all. And so they lumped into that sort of anti-Facebook people. And so that's what they should do to Trump. They should sort of let him say whatever he wants to say. It goes to the people who follow him. But, you know, don't let it be amplified by the mechanisms of Twitter.
But this is where...
But you're talking about a shadow ban. You're talking about a shadow
ban. Yeah, but this is where... Historically, we're challenged by a leader like Trump. The press is also challenged because none of the norms that we have. I mean, the norm would be, no, he's the president of the United States. He should be able to speak to the people of the United States. That norm, you'd be violating that with a shadow ban. It's why this is so challenging for the press. It's why it's so challenging for Jack Dorsey at Twitter. What do you do?
It also wouldn't work, actually. And
you got a crazy grandpa, and he's got a tweet. He's got a tweeter, and he's not afraid to use it.
Well, it's worse than that because Trump is actually not all that effective. If you look at the performance and engagement of his tweets on Twitter, what happens
is all
the media picks up his tweets, and that's where it's amplified. Right. It's amplified by the press. That's right. Why we're always hearing about Trump's tweets. It's not.
Yeah,
that's
Twitter.
A good point. I don't follow him because it's too upsetting.
I think that's a really good lesson. You know, I'm going to say this, and I'm exactly as guilty of it as many other people are. But there's a certain tendency with Democrats that when someone on the right wing says something that's snarkable, right? Like something you can easily make fun of, you know, you dunk on it, you quote tweet it for easy engagement, and you know, and I don't want this to be a political show, but, you know, for some figures on the right, Ben Shapiro, they really depend on that kind of outrage and snark response to amplify it and help build their career. So I find that I try to be very judicious about which of Trump's temper tantrums that I amplify, because in a way you're helping him win. And It's so difficult. You know, Richard Stengel is a former, he used to work at the State Department with John Kerry. He wrote a fantastic book called Information Warfare. And he talks about, like, for many journalists, you go and you want to be an information idealist. You want to believe that the best information out there, it wins, give people the best arguments, let them make their own decisions. But the truth is, in information warfare, we kind of have to be information realists and realize the effects of these things a lot more. And I just think it's a no-win scenario.
Facebook is trying to self-regulate. They've created a... Oh, you already a laugh.
Sorry.
They've created a new board. They've revealed the first 20 members of the new review board. Those 20 will then nominate another 20 for a total of 40. They're, I think everybody would agree, a good bunch, a diverse bunch, global, distinguished activists as well as scholars. They are going to try to help Facebook solve the content problems, which is a pretty insurmountable problem. Hate speech, harassment, protecting safety and privacy. They say the board in an op-ed in the New York Times said, we will make final and binding decisions on whether specific content should be allowed or removed from Facebook and Instagram. On the other hand, Wired in its piece, this is Siva Vaidyanathan, who I love. He wrote, Facebook and the folly of self-regulation. He took issue. He said, only in the narrowest and most trivial of ways does this board have any such power. It will have no influence over anything that really matters in the world. It will hear only individual appeals about specific content that the company has removed from the surface, already removed, and only a fraction of those appeals. It can't say anything about the toxic content that Facebook allows and promotes on the site. It will have no authority over advertising or the massive surveillance that Facebook uses to make its ads so valuable. It won't curb disinformation campaigns or dangerous conspiracies, and on and on and on. It's an interesting idea. I commend Facebook for doing it, but it's hard for any group of 40 people to influence what happens with a 2.5 billion user service.
Well, so let me throw ice water on your enthusiasm for this. I'm sorry. Do I do this very quickly? So essentially, Facebook has put another football up for the press to kick. And we're like, okay, this time she's not going to pull it away. What they're setting up here is, like he said, that there's no power there. It's an advisory position. And they're trying to make this committee as illustrious and as respected and balanced as possible.
And they succeeded at that.
So then they'll just go ahead and remove what they want to remove and not remove what they don't want to remove.
Right.
And on those cases where they remove controversial stuff that they want to remove,
then
that
they
is
can
also
blame these guys.
Proved by the committee, they can say, well, they said.
Right.
And then when they don't remove stuff that the committee advises them to do, they said, well, we have a business to run, we have our own reasons, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just a fig leaf to get the press off their backs, yeah. Which is it's basically their only goal here.
It's also very, very narrow. I mean, they're looking at individual cases. There's no guarantee that anything that they do is going to affect overall policy at Facebook. And what they're doing is they're essentially presented with a case. They look at it, rule next. And there's no, you know, there's nothing there that requires Facebook to pay attention to what they're doing in terms of policy. And it's pretty much chrome on a car.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Well, there you have it. Did you want to say anything, Brianna? The laugh spoke volumes.
I absolutely agree with the pessimism. It's dead on. I would say it is a slight movement forward, and I do like the fact that people outside the company are going to be looking at this very narrow case of things. I like the fact that Facebook has agreed to independently fund them for a few years. I think that's a step forward. But is this fundamentally going to change the way Facebook operates? No, it really strikes me as when Uber got into the trouble with Susan Fowler, and they brought in, wasn't it Eric Holder to look at the culture there? Holder's law firm to look at it. Yep. And they put that in every single press statement. So they were using someone else's credibility to address a fault that they've had. Maybe that's too cynical a view here, but that's how I feel.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what they're doing.
Oh, well, you got my hopes up for a minute anyway. I guess they're going to yank that football away one more time. Let's take a little break. What a panel. I'm going to try to find more great, deep, heavy stuff to talk about, but we may end up talking about Unreal Engine 5 as well.
Yes.
Brianna Wu, back to her old role as a game developer.
That's right.
She's loving it. It's also great to have you here. It's just at Brianna Wu. Can we put anything else down there? You got lots of room in that lower third now.
Oh, my gosh. Former candidate for Congress, game developer, head of development at GSX.
Can you go back?
Figure out what I'm doing next.
Can you go back to Space Cat Gal now?
I don't think I want to. I think Brianna Wu, that's more professional. So.
She's got her real name. For years on Twitter, she was Space Cat Gal.
That's it.
Then the campaign said, you know, it'd be good.
Oh, they were angry about that. Oh, my gosh.
It'd be good for votes if you would use your name. It's like my team. They say, Leo, no one knows what a netcast is. Why do you persist? Just give it up, old man. Dwight Silverman knows what a netcast is, but he probably
I do.
Yes. He's from the Tech Burger, HoustonChronicle.com/TechBurger. It's great to have you in your soundproof booth.
It looks like a sound.
How do you sterilize the egg cartons behind you?
I don't think I have to. I just won't lick them.
Okay, good. Good thinking. Good thinking. Yeah, good thinking. And, of course, Mike Elgin. It's great to have Mike. I'm glad you're stuck at home. I know you're not, but I kind of am. We get more.
Yeah, it's actually great. I'm with family. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm very lucky. I know there are a lot of single people who are quarantining by themselves.
That's got to be so hard.
It's got to be so awful. So I'm just so lucky to be with family.
You know what's worse than quarantining single? Quarantining with people you don't like.
Yes. Yes. Who wish they were single.
Yeah, right. And that happens too, I got to tell you, more often than not. Yeah.
Who I feel sorry for are the parents where the school districts are doing online education, and they're trying to work from home at the same time. That is, and I know several of these, and a lot of these parents are just throwing up their hands and saying, I can't do it. I can't do it.
We have good friends with three school-age kids from like first grade through fifth grade, and there's five of them. They're all working from home. There's just not enough Zoom. There's not enough Zoom to go around. Actually, Zoom was down this morning for about 3 hours in many parts of the country, the Northeast, California, Texas, and it was 9 a.m. Eastern time, right when church services hit, and I think there were a lot of churches who were very unhappy that Zoom was down for 3 hours. We still don't know why that was. Zoom says they're all back up and running. I bet there are also a few people saying, oh, thank God. No Zoom.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Just a little bit. Just give me an hour. No Zoom. Did you keep somewhere to live, Mike? Or are you just like camping on your son's couch?
It's something like that. He has a bedroom. It's mostly where we stay when we are in California. So,
yeah. So it's not.
It works out great.
Yeah,
we're all foodies. We're doing a lot of cooking and stuff. We're having a lot of fun. It's pretty great. We're in Campbell, in Silicon Valley.
Nice
so,
area. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really great. I have a prepared statement about Zoom, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Some quick advice and a prediction.
Yes.
So, the Zoom fatigue is real. Everybody's written about it. Ugh. We've all experienced it. Ugh. It's just awful. There are a whole bunch of reasons for it. There are psychological reasons having to do with latency and people staring at you. And there's all kinds of problems with video conferencing that involves lots and lots of people. And so I'm advising companies in my columns to get away from them as much as possible. And those of us who have been working from home, I've been working from home, working remotely since 2004. We didn't have all these video conferencing when we were remote and everybody else was in the office. It's just now that the managers and the leaders are working from home. Now we have to have video conferencing, right?
Because
they're going to be touchy-feely types.
Right.
So my advice is try to not have the meeting. Do it in email if you can. If you can't do it in email, do a conference call with audio. And if that doesn't work, try to keep Zoom calls to four people or less, because beyond that, people go crazy. But I'm going to make a prediction, which is I think the future of video conferencing, the thing that will replace it, will be avatar-based video conferencing, where people's Memoji. I think that Apple will probably announce Memoji on the MacBook platform or the iMac platform, and people will have their emoji doing their face expressions, moving their mouth, doing all the things that they would do. But
that's going to make it worse.
That will make it
worse. It solves a lot of problems.
That's too. It's too freaky. So we do.
I don't want to have a conference call with a bunch of Lego characters.
You have a Minecraft server. You know?
So that's true. I would do it in
Second Life.
Yeah, well, that's what this sounds like.
I have a friend of mine in the game industry. They've started holding their team meetings in Red Dead Redemption.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Around the campfire and have voice
chat. That's a great idea.
And do it that way, yes.
Can you do it so there's a lobby you could go into, and then everybody's hanging in the lobby?
Exactly. Something like that. It's a little more
involved. That can you, if somebody says something you don't like, can you draw your six gun and shoot them?
There we go. Or if they say something you do like, you can share your moonshine
Good. Right. Hey, it's good stuff.
So we have weekly staff meetings for the entire editorial staff of the Chronicle. It's about 200 of us, but about 100 showed up the last time. But most of them are on, I'd say probably about 40% of them are on phone, the rest are on video, and there are some who do video but don't show their faces. And actually, we all love it because we get to see each other. It only lasts about 40 minutes. The editor does much of the talking, and there are questions via chat. And it's really good to see everybody's face.
I have to say, it does feel passive-aggressive not to show your video in a Zoom call.
You don't know where they are.
Just your name is there in big letters. It's like, that's really...
But it's great. And so, there's not much anxiety around it with us. Everybody kind of likes to see, cats will jump in people's laps, and everybody enjoys that. And it's kind of more human. It humanizes staff. And I would not want to see a bunch of avatars.
Let me be clear, Dwight. I'm not saying this is good. I'm predicting it will happen.
Yeah.
And I'm predicting Apple will launch it. Facebook just announced their Memoji-like
rooms. Yeah.
So I think this is really going to take off. I think over the a year from now, avatar-based video conferencing is going to be enormous. That's just a prediction.
When Facebook came out with Spaces, their virtual reality hangout, we played with that a little bit. But that's also a little... I think it's not that we hate Zoom. I agree with you, Dwight. It's fatiguing.
It's too much.
It's fatiguing after a while. Last week I did my 43rd college reunion. One of my old roommates got, kind of put it together. There was only about a dozen of us. It wasn't everybody, but it was old friends. Hadn't seen each other in some cases in 43 years, in some cases just a decade or two. It was wonderful. And seeing their faces was great. Although I have to apologize because one guy I go, I don't know who this is. Who's this guy? The whole time. And then I finally figured out who it is. And I went, oh, my God, that's you. So I apologize. It was you changed a little bit.
People are having a lot of fun with Zoom and they're getting a lot of enjoyment out of it in certain circumstances. But I'm talking to a lot of people who are having two or three or four Zoom meetings a day with 30, 40 or 50 people on the call.
That's a different scenario.
Yes. But that's the norm. Dwight, yes. I think that's becoming the norm. Yeah. Poor Lisa spends almost all day on Zoom. Because she's working out of the house. I have to get out. I have to come over here. Because the one day that I did three Zoom calls, it was like, and I'm on camera all day. It's not that. I don't know what it is. There's something different about it. I don't know.
Do you think that Microsoft Build is this week? And one of the more interesting products I saw them debut was HoloLens 2. And they did this really interesting feature with it where they would use texture maps of your face, and they would put it over a 3D skeletal mesh to make like a 3D representation of you. It wasn't perfect, but it was good. And then you could walk around it in the round. As we're sitting here talking today, Magic Leap has basically imploded. like the Death
Isn't
Star.
Sad?
Oh, it's terrible. I know so many people laid off because they hired a bunch of game industry people. But I mean, do you think that in the meeting space, like something like AR, there might be applications? Because I mean, in engineering, so much of there's some people that can work like closing the door and working by themselves all day. I'm not like that. I have to talk to my team. I've got to diagram stuff out. Do you think that there could be limited applications for AR where you could be with the team more virtually in a way that felt more real? Because I think we all agree Oculus is not the answer for that. It's just too removed from everything. It feels arcadey. But I could see an opening for HoloLens here.
I can't wait.
There's a huge area. Is there?
The new Zoom with skeletal mesh renderings is going to be all the rage.
The Apple glasses, which I'm sure we'll talk about.
Okay, let's take a break because that you brought up some really good stuff. I want to talk about Magic Leap. I want to talk about the Apple glasses. And I think this is a really interesting conversation is, you know, now that we're all doing these meetings, where do we go to make them less fatiguing, more productive? Is there some solution in technology? So this is a great subject. I love it. I don't want to cut you off, but let's take a pause. So we can thank a sponsor, and we'll be right back. What a great panel. I love it when we get these conversations and they start flowing like this, and I hate to interrupt it, but I do want to talk about Wasabi, our good friends at Wasabi. I heard that.
I like them. They're awesome.
I know. They're in Boston. They're in your neighborhood.
Yeah.
It's David Friend, who I've known for years, another Yaley. He was very famous. He created the ARP synthesizer. He's got a serial entrepreneur. He created Carbonite. He has created something that I think is the next step, the next generation in hot cloud storage. It's incredible. It's called Wasabi, aptly named for hot cloud storage, right? It's the perfect solution. If, for instance, if you're a managed service provider, you're going to love it because you can make more money and still charge your clients less. That's because Wasabi is 80% cheaper than Amazon S3. Significantly, it's so affordable, it's actually cheaper than on-prem storage. In fact, typically, you could store that data in Wasabi's cloud for less than just the annual maintenance fees on the same amount of on-prem storage. That's how affordable it is. David was telling me about a Boston high-rise, you know, an office building, where they put in security cameras all over. And they're, you know, these cameras are pumping out a lot of data all day, every day. And they're buying hard drives. They're buying more hard drives every week. It seems like they're going out and buying more hard drives. And they're going crazy. He said they moved to Wasabi. It costs them less. It's more accessible. It's better. It's faster. It's easier. And I have to say, I think Wasabi is more secure than on-prem storage. I think it really is. First of all, they've got an incredible 11 nines of durability. That's one, on average, one file every 649,000 years. They're hosted in highly secure, fully redundant Tier 4 data centers. They do regular integrity checking, where every object is checked for integrity every 90 days. That means one bit is lost. They've got a copy on the other data center. They move it over. You never lose any data. It's also secure by default. All data in the cloud is Wasabi Cloud is encrypted at rest, even if you don't specify it. It's automatic. Of course, they follow industry best security models and design practices. They've got access control mechanisms like bucket policies and ACLs. My favorite thing, though, I love this. You can designate some or all of your data immutable. It cannot be erased. It cannot be altered. It cannot be encrypted by ransomware. It is protected from hackers, from malware, protected from yourself. It is completely safe. So this is definitely better than on-prem storage. And because Wasabi has this patented way of writing the data to hard drives, they are faster than S3. They are less expensive than S3. They don't have all the complex storage tiers that S3 has. There's no fee at all for egress. That'll bite you a lot with S3, where you say, oh, this is cheap, and then you start to get your data, and it's what? API requests, they use the same API as Amazon S3, so you already know how to use it. You have software that can use it, but they don't charge for API requests. This is a completely disruptive price performance model. And now there's a new way. You can pay as you go, and it's very affordable, $5.99 per terabyte per month. That's it, flat fee. but you can even save more with reserved capacity storage. If you're that high rise and you know we're going to be eating up petabytes every, you know, 2 petabytes every year, you can do reserved capacity storage. You buy the cloud storage kind of ahead of time. You can do 1, 3, or 5 year increments. And of course, the longer you, the bigger the amount, the longer the tier, the better the discount. So you can really bring that price way down. And there's a lot of situations where you know we're going to need this storage. We are generating this much data. So reserve capacity storage is a very good reason to take a look at Wasabi. You know, it's good to be number two. You got to try harder. You got to work harder. And that's what Wasabi is. HIPAA compliant, FINRA compliant, CJIS compliant, highly secure, disruptive technology. It's turning the industry on its ear. 80% cheaper, up to 6 times the speed of the industry leader. You can calculate the savings for yourself and start a free trial right now at wasabi.com. Click the free trial link. Please use our offer code TWIT so they know you saw it here. Wasabi, WASABI.com. Free trial, offer code TWIT. I think you're going to, once you try it, you're going to, and it's what's nice is you're going to save so much. You can easily go to the boss, say, look what we're saving. Look how good this is. I know usually bosses go, well, is it Amazon? Is it Microsoft? Is it Google? No, you don't have to. This conversation will be a lot easier. And if you're a managed service provider, your clients are going to love you. And we're going to cut your costs. We'll cut them by half. And you still make more money. Wasabi, WASABI.com. Click the free trial link. Enter the code TWIT. And I know a lot of people like you, Brianna, who are using Wasabi for themselves, for backup, for cloud. There's, you know, it's so affordable that a lot of people are just using it, not businesses, but it's really intended for businesses. But I just thought I'd mention that. All right, let's talk, because I think this will tie into that future of conferencing. There's a little battle going on between two Apple rumor mongers, Ming-Chi Kuo, who is in Asia. So he's the supply chain guy. And he's, you know, I would say Ming-Chi Kuo is maybe 75% accurate. He's missed on a few things. He said Apple will not be shipping augmented reality glasses until 2022. But there's this new guy, the new sheriff in town, a guy named John Prosser, who of late has been remarkably on. He got the iPhone SE down perfectly. Kuo said Apple's glasses will launch 2022 at the earliest. Prosser says, I can't believe I'm going against Kuo on this one, but I believe he's wrong. Apple glasses are aimed for March, June 2021. Also, I've seen them. They're sleek as hell. We'll be showing you soon. Prosser does not, we should be very clear, does not work for Apple. He's a, you know, a tech guy, analyst. He had a YouTube channel for a while, but he's got good sources. He's been very, very accurate in the last 6 months. Now, you've been talking, I'm going to let Mike start with this, because you've been talking about this whole idea for a long time. You were a glass hole.
Yes. In my heart, I still am.
You know. You wore that Google Glass for a long time.
I do think that, and that's a heads-up display, which is different from augmented reality, right, which interacts with the physical environment in ways that a heads-up display like Google Glass does not. But I do believe in the Apple glasses. I do believe in the future of augmented reality. I actually think it's probably the thing that will replace the iPhone in terms of the central device in our lives. But I do believe that Apple is working on combining multiple devices, including glasses, together into singular experiences. One of them is what we're talking about, which is holographic meetings, where, and Apple has patents for this sort of thing, that they describe this very scenario where you can sit at a conference table or not. And basically you have people from the waist up, their avatars, sitting around. You can look at them. They can look at you.
That's what I want. That that's works. What I always wanted to do with Twit. That's exactly why you're in a little TV screen, but it'd be, I always wanted you to have a 3D rendering of Mike Elgin sitting right there, and we wouldn't have to ever, nobody have to come, right?
And it wouldn't age. That's the best part about avatars. But if you
look at Lego Mike Elgin.
That would be great. That's plug me in. I'm ready.
Little dot on his head. Yeah,
that's right. But if there's a company called Spatial that is describing this. They're in the news this week as well, and they're working on this holographic meeting idea for enterprises. But Apple's vision would be you have a MacBook Pro in front of you, and it's essentially doing the mapping that their Face ID does on the iPhone, mapping you in real time. Everybody else has got a MacBook Pro in front of them. They're wearing the Apple glasses. And so what you essentially see is looking over your MacBook Pro, you see one person there, another person there, another person there. And you can turn and talk to them. They look at you. You make eye contact with their avatar. And this is the future of virtual meetings. This is a brilliant and infinitely doable concept, especially if you avatarize it and don't try to have, you know, essentially what looks like video. That will come eventually. Back to this pissing contest between these two analysts. I think I think 2022 is more realistic. It's one thing to predict the arrival of a version of an existing product. It's another thing to predict the arrival of an entirely new platform from a company like Apple. Apple's never early on these things. They sort of tend to hold back and wait until it's already happening, and then they come in and just take over with a beautiful implementation. So next year for Apple glasses to me feels really far-fetched given what's happening or what isn't happening in the world of AR.
There's no history of Apple doing developer editions. Like, so the Google Glass was a developer edition. They didn't intend.
Yes.
And Magic Leap did the same thing. But Apple does not have a history of that. Typically, they keep it quiet. They, you know, quietly seed this to a few select developers and then announce it as a consumer product.
But
there are many. They kind of did though, Leo, because if you look at the history of Apple in 3D. So when I first started working with Apple technology in 2011, Apple's 3D APIs were absolutely non-existent. They had SpriteKit for games, which is why so many games on the iPhone when it first came out were 2D. But if you look at the state of things, they've really been making big investments into AR and 3D technology. I believe it was 2 years ago that they finally went and they supported eGPU on any MacBook or iMac or Series Mac device, so you could hook up a VR or AR goggle set to it and start learning to work with Apple technologies with these kinds of devices. It wasn't specifically an Apple product on the back end, but if you kind of read the smoke and look at the frameworks that have been announced year after year after year at the State of the Union, they're very clearly moving in this direction. And it's really gotten very good. If you think about what a small, sleek Apple device is going to need, it's going to be less like an Oculus with, you know, sensors placed all around the room. It's going to be closer to the Facebook Oculus, the goggle headset that reads it. Right, the Quest.
Yeah.
So
the Quest is great because you're not tied up,
yeah.
But it has the disadvantage of VR, which is, so what if the Apple goggles, these are safety glasses. This is actually what I wear as part of my shopping kit these days. But what if I think you would want Apple to do something stylish that looked like real spectacles, and presumably they would have prescription lenses in them.
And Prosser said they were sleek. The ones
sleek.
You've seen were sleek.
Yeah. Yeah. But I would wear, if it looked like this, if it had a little Apple on it, I'd wear it.
I would.
So Leo, yeah, one of the things about
you wear Google Glass, that's not any testimony at all, Michael.
What if the 2021 date is aspirational? In other words, that the 2022 date is kind of what they initially were shooting for and what they thought they could pull together. But looking at what is happening now and with the virtualization of business and the virtualization of socialization. What if they're saying we need to get this out the door sooner now? This is aspirational.
I will offer an evidence, an article from The Information, which is also very well connected. Back in November, they were talking about an all hands meeting at which Apple executives discussed a 2022 release for an AR headset and a 2023 release for glasses. But as you point out, Dwight, that was November was a lifetime ago.
And a lot of things have changed a lot.
Yeah.
And so the fatigue, you know, that we've all been talking about, the desire for something different in terms of the way people gather together online may be driving Apple to say, let's see what we could do sooner rather than later.
Here's what the information said, which would kind of confirm your thoughts, Brianna. Apple's headset, codenamed N301, will offer a hybrid of AR and VR capabilities. It resembles the Oculus Quest, a Facebook virtual reality headset released earlier this year, but with a sleeker, there's that sleek word, design. By the way, as somebody in the chat room pointed out, when you have really good sources at a company like Apple, it often is the case that Apple is feeding you stuff that it wants to be kind of put out there. So the fact that sleek has appeared now twice, it makes me a little suspicious. Cameras will be mounted on the outside of the device. Google Glass had a side camera on the temple, right? Allowing people to see and interact with their physical surroundings. The Oculus Quest has cameras as well. In fact, Facebook came out with a way that you don't have to hold a physical device in your hand anymore. It can see your fingers with the cameras, and it can tell what you're doing well enough that you don't need a device anymore. That's a huge improvement. Apple, according to the information, wants to make heavy use of fabrics and lightweight materials to ensure the device is comfortable to wear for extended periods of time. This was all a presentation at the Steve Jobs Theater in October. Filled the theater, 1,000 people, for internal, though, intended for people working on this project. The headset will, so this is a, I would say, a well-sourced leak. The headset will have a high-resolution display that will allow users to read small type and see other people standing in front of and behind virtual objects. It'll be able to map surfaces. Apple's working on that, of course, with ARKit and its phones. Edges and dimensions of rooms with greater accuracy than existing devices on the market, executives said at the meeting. They were shown at the meeting a recording of a demonstration in which a virtual coffee machine was placed on a real kitchen table surrounded by people in a room. The virtual coffee machine obscured people standing behind it. This is the ultimate Zoom machine. Apple. Now, this may be why the year 2021 comes up. Apple is planning to reach out to third-party software developers as early as 2021 to encourage them to build apps. So in order to do that, Brianna, wouldn't they have to have a prototype?
Yeah, I mean, it will be like they did with the iMac Pro and the Mac Pro. Like, you get the Apple ships you a device and it's got wires sticking out of it and you can't access it or look at it, but you can develop things on it. I imagine it will be something like that. I do have to say, though, the one thing that gives me pause about this product is look at the really big feature on the last iPad Pro that came out, you know, with the Magic Keyboard shipping, which is a fantastic product. It works with either the last gen iPad Pro or the one they just unveiled. And the one really big feature with that is the AR capabilities. If you look in the App Store for AR apps and you're like, okay, what are they shipping that would justify me spending, you know, $1,200, $1,300 on a new iPad? Other than video conferencing, it really feels like most of the AR, you know, applications that they've come up with have been very niche. It's things like playing Lego games on tabletops, or, you know, having a virtual tape measure to measure, or, you know, shopping at IKEA and drawing like, you know, furniture in your room. So I'm interested in this technology, and I think it certainly has some interesting game applications, but I do think it's very worthwhile noting that Oculus has not been able to really figure this out. Apple technology with AR to date and ARKit has not really been able to figure this out. It seems like a technology in search of a problem, if that makes sense.
Our show today brought to you by ZipRecruiter. This is a different kind of ad from ZipRecruiter. I'm just going to read their message verbatim because I think it's really it's touching. During this time of change, we want you to know that ZipRecruiter's focus has not changed. They're still doing what they've always done, helping people find work and helping businesses find the right people for their open roles. If you're looking for a job, ZipRecruiter's working with you to find the right job faster. They're dedicated to helping you get hired, from caretaking to delivering foods and goods, to building medical facilities, supplying protective equipment, and so much more. In fact, ZipRecruiter's app will send you up-to-date job openings so you can be one of the first to apply. And if you're actively hiring, ZipRecruiter will invite candidates to apply to your most urgent roles, making it faster and easier to reach the people you need. By connecting people who need jobs and companies that need people, ZipRecruiter is working with all of us so we can keep moving forward. Let's work together. That's ZipRecruiter.com/work together. And boy, you know, I just personally couldn't be a better time for a company like ZipRecruiter. We're very grateful that they're around and that they're part of our family. ZipRecruiter.com/work together. Some of our best employees came to us from ZipRecruiter. And I know with two kids who just graduated from college and don't have great job prospects, having something like ZipRecruiter, and that both Abby and Henry are going regularly there to find jobs, is a really, really huge resource. So the Quest-like device would be 2022, but then, as I said, the glasses would come out the following year. They're meant to be worn, according to Apple's presentation, they're meant to be worn all day, and current prototypes look like high-priced sunglasses with thick frames that house the battery and chips. This is the information quoting a person who's seen them. They've also patented a use of lenses that darken when people are using AR on them as a way to let you know, oh, this person's not paying attention. He's looking at something. And Apple did
that.
That
would be creepy.
Yeah.
That would be really creepy.
You know, we've seen in science fiction all the time, people freeze.
Yeah.
Or they're staring in space.
As a husband, I don't like that at all.
So keep in mind that Apple, when it was developing the iPhone and the iPad, started out doing the iPad. And then they said, you know, this would be better as a phone.
Right.
And they stopped.
Right.
And they switched to the phone. And then they came back to the iPad.
Right.
So, if you're looking for an explanation of the discrepancies, you might think about that behavior with the glasses.
People, versus the headset. Apple senior managers also told the group they believe later versions of the glasses could replace iPhones in roughly a decade. And, of course, that's what Apple really, if I were running Apple, that's what you're looking for. What's the next iPhone? You had such a hit. The company was transformed by the iPhone. You'd got to be looking for the next thing because it's not going to last forever.
How do you keep up this growth? Do you choose to level off and start declining, or do you look for another thing that's even bigger than this cash cow of the iPhone? And I really think that this is a part of that. And you can always see where Google's going because they build some of the future technology into current products. And I don't think there's been enough attention given to something called the U1 chip, which is an ultra wideband chip in the iPhone. They're using it for almost nothing in the iPhone. You can basically it will prioritize what you're going to do, the sort of
airdrop,
sending people airdrop. File transfer, it'll prioritize it based on where you point the phone. That's a really trivial use for this really advanced technology. I really think that chip is going into the glasses, and it will be able to identify the pretty accurate location of things in your environment. And another thing to point out, though, is that we always think visually in terms of glasses. And of course, there will be visual. The whole point of it is to have a visual frame of reference where you're capturing information, 3D information with these cameras, and you're also seeing things in your field of view. That's the whole point of augmented reality. But the other part of it is with glasses that you're wearing all day, you have an audio input that is not AirBuds or something in your ears. It's something that will probably combine bone conduction with little speakers that enable you to be receiving audio information all day long without discomfort. And if you look at all the audio-based things, moving Apple News to audio, doing all these different things, they know that audio is the future. And the best platform for delivering audio all day long without discomfort is a pair of glasses. And so the way Apple tends to do things is they take super advanced technology and they roll it out in a very basic way that really, really works right off the bat. So these Apple glasses at minimum are going to work with their tile system to find your keys in the living room. You basically see something floating in 3D space. Those are my keys. There's my wallet. They'll have audio input that you can have all day. Siri will be talking to you in whispering in your ear all day. Also based on contextual information, it'll be able to get information from the environment with these sensors and then tell you things with Siri's voice that will help you navigate your day, do walking directions, et cetera. So they'll the initial concept of the glasses is not going to be some super advanced HoloLens type of thing. It's going to be a very basic, very solid, practical collection of features that will basically thrill people. And it'll use advanced technologies to do basic things. And I think that will be very acceptable market. And it's also something they can or could do 2022, 2023. I think it's completely doable to do something like that.
If you put together all the pieces of the puzzle, it does look like Apple's working towards something. The augmented reality in the iPhone, now in the LiDAR and the iPad, the AirBuds or AirPods. I mean, it feels like they're moving in this direction. You're right. News Plus being audio now. So it does Face feel ID. Like they're putting this together. Face ID. But you brought up the cautionary tale, Brianna, of Magic Leap.
Right.
I think everybody here and everybody listening is excited by the notion of this science fiction thing, these augmented reality glasses. And clearly Apple is trying to make it happen. Doesn't guarantee a success. And Magic Leap is a perfect example. What happened at Magic Leap, Brianna?
I mean, so, you know, just to give listeners or viewers a little bit of background, you know, they had massive, massive venture capital cash. It was one of the biggest in the entire history of, you know, launching companies. It was vaporware. We never saw a product. Eventually, they had this kind of alliance with AT&T and brought this product out. And long story short, they did not have experiences that sold the product. So if you went to AT&T and said, I want to look at Magic Leap, I want to see if this is something worth buying or developing for, they didn't have anything that made consumers go, I want to go out and buy that. And Leah, this is what concerns me, because when I look at the people I personally know that were laid off from Magic Leap this week and last week, they're not people without talent. They are AAA developers, very smart people in UI and animation. They know how to make good experiences objectively. And this is what gives me pause, that if they have all of that money and talent sitting around, granted they don't have the Apple name, but if they couldn't make an experience that got Magic Leap to the next level, and Apple doesn't currently have anything in the App Store with their AR kit that makes me go, hey, I want to go buy a new iPad to take advantage of that. I'm fundamentally asking myself, what are we going to build with this that's going to get the public to go, you know, invest $1,000, $2,000 in a pair of glasses? Because that's a big ask.
Dwight?
Well,
your thoughts?
So, you know, a lot, I keep going back to the description that Mike had of this world where people are avataring everywhere. And it's, you know, it strikes me it may exist in the uncanny valley, that it's the kind of thing that techies think it would be really cool to do that. But that when you get it, try to put this on the face of everyday people, that it has to be so intuitive, so simple, and so realistic that you don't mind. And that may be what happened with Magic Leap, is that there was too much computer science getting in the way of what they wanted to do. Apple is better at making things human, but you still, you know, with some of the things that they do, you could still smell the computer science. And I worry that, you know, people like Mike and I and Brianna and you want this, but that everyday folks, as Brianna said, are not going to want to shell out $1,000 or $2,000 to live like that.
Yeah. I think if they can get it to do it, it will become the new normal. I think it will take off. It's just going to be difficult. You know, Amy Webb, who's on the show regularly, consulted with Magic Leap. She had tried the fancy Magic Leap, not the Magic Leap 1, the developer thing they put out. She's still a believer. Her thought was, the problem is you can't do a venture capital-based company to develop something like this. It's too long-term. It's too blue sky.
And, but Apple could.
Well, that's the point. VC wants a turnaround too quickly for this to have ever have worked. This really is something that should come out of a university. It should come out of a government, come out of a lab. It is blue sky R&D. There are very few companies, IBM, you know, remember Bell Labs, that will put that kind of money into R&D. Apple's R&D spending historically used to be very, very low. Over the last 5 years, it's gone up and up and up and up and up. I think Apple's the kind of company that doesn't see this as a short-term VC-like investment. I'm sure they see some urgency because they've sold everybody in the world an iPhone. There's nowhere else to go. So they need the next thing. But I also think that they have maybe more patience than the investors in Magic Leap had. So it doesn't – but you're right. It doesn't mean that they can do it. It just means that they have perhaps more stamina.
And if anybody could do it.
Yeah, if anybody could do it.
Yeah, I mean
– if anybody could do it,
sort of, right. Absolutely. That's absolutely true. The difference is, though, if you're getting more venture capital than any other company, especially if you're based in Florida – and you have to say, okay, we're going to take this new technology that we're developing and we're going to revolutionize science. It's going to be used by astronauts. We're going to recreate the world. You have to do that to justify the massive amounts of capital. You have to make a big play. Apple has to make a small play. If you look at the role of AirBuds in our lives, you know, we all used a Sony Walkman back in the day, except maybe Brianna. and back in the day, when you put something over your ears,
I can see Brianna bopping down the avenue.
I
don't know.
Did you? Okay.
My dad gave me his.
So. Okay. So back in the day, you put things over your head because you were going to listen to an album, right? I mean, I'm going to listen to music now. And you put on something over you. So now how do people use their AirBuds? They're controlling the audio. They're getting notifications. They're interacting with Siri. They're playing music. They're doing calls. They're doing all kinds of stuff. Essentially, it's a way that enhances the phone, mostly. It takes all the stuff in your phone and it makes it much better. And I think that's what these glasses are going to do. It's going to do for the phone what the AirPods did for the phone, which is just give you another sense, another physical human sense to interact with your phone and its content better. You'll be able to control things in space. Instead of double tapping on your earbuds, you can swipe with an in-the-air gesture, for example. You'll get notifications when you hear the bleep bleep. You can just see it. Oh, so-and-so is, iMessaging me right now. That's better than pulling your phone out of your pocket. All of these things are not life-changing revolutions. They are little things that feel really good. That's what Apple is going to do with these glasses, I think.
I hope so. I just want to say one of the reasons I believe VR failed is because it's exactly like you're saying, Mike. We were thinking about ideas that didn't take advantage of the technology that we were aiming towards. VR, what we ended up doing is funding a bunch of startups that were bringing ideas from the game industry instead of starting new ideas that were kind of from scratch. So Robo Recall is a great example. It's a VR game. It's a fantastic game. It's made in Unreal Engine. It's a great immersive shooter. But even for someone like me that lives and dies by that kind of technology, I can only play it for 20 minutes and I get bored because it's taking an idea from the game industry that's really better on a PlayStation sitting in front of a TV.
Yeah.
So I think if this is going to be better, we need to be thinking about like mundane things too. Like what about someone working in a warehouse trying to find different things there or working in a data center, you know? Swapping that out. That's a good application of AR or somebody at a courthouse trying to find records. I just, I think like we have this idea of a science fiction future. And I think when AR starts, it's going to be a lot more mundane. It's going to be like you said, Mike, like reading Apple News articles to you.
Well, if you think about it, the Apple Watch started really as just a sidecar to the phone and has slowly gained some stature. It's not quite a standalone device yet, but that is a gradual evolution that's taken it, what, 5 years? And I could see, that's the thing. I think we all would love to get these glasses tomorrow, but it's not going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen in a year. It's not going to happen in 5 years.
But I think the Apple Watch is a great example of what is likely with the glasses. I mean, we were all kind of disappointed in the Apple Watch for the first year, 2 years, 3 years. And it gradually, and when nobody was looking, became like this fantastic wearable. It's really great now. And it was just, it just creeped. There was no big aha moment. It just sort of just got better and better and better.
Yes.
That's probably what's going to happen with the glasses. They're going to come out. We're all going to crap all over them. they're going to disappoint everyone. And then over the next 5 years, they're going to become amazing.
I should point out that Apple acquired a company called Next VR. All that's on the Next VR page now is Next VR is headed in a new direction. But this was a platform for 3D virtual reality sports, music, and entertainment experiences. And so it's an interesting acquisition for Apple. It fits perfectly in with what Apple's doing, except that Apple has no VR or AR. So why did they buy these guys? All right, let's take a little break. We got more to talk about. And I've got to figure out what that thing is behind Brianna. I don't know if that's,
my 3D printer.
Oh, okay.
It's my Lulzbot TAS workhorse.
That's your TAS.
It's amazing.
Oh. You know, next time, could you have it printing something during the show, or is it really
I could,
loud?
Absolutely. Yeah, okay. It's not that
fun.
Loud.
Yeah, it'd give us something, you know, like we could watch it. It's like a cooking show. Slowly
can I tell you,
making
my
something.
Husband, he will whip up anything. He's so good in 3D. There was the TV back there. I wanted an Apple TV shelf for it. He just opened up Inventor Fusion and 3D modeled me one last night. That's printing on our other printer right now.
See, I want, that's what I, if 3D printers would do that, I would get one. But mostly it seems like they're down for adjustment.
Oh, yeah. It's really quirky.
I want the power of a 3D printer without the hassle of a 3D printer. I could think of a lot of things. I want to make face masks. I want to make, not breathing masks. I'm already sewing those. I want one of those clear plastic shields. I want a face shield. You could 3D.
Or something like Bane.
Like Bane.
I have some 3D copper filament for this. There's a special medicinal filament that came out, and it's bacteria and viruses won't stick to copper. It's what they use to sterilize it. So they came out with this filament, and Frank and I are waiting. He's a microbiologist. He has a PhD in microbiology, we're going to print a face mask on that TAS workhorse, and then we're going to run a test with this filament and see, it says that things can't grow on it. Let's make sure that's true before we start printing these out.
It'd be like Bane. It'd be like a hard mask.
I cannot get COVID-19. Go ahead and try.
I like it. We're going to have more with Brianna Wu, former candidate for Congress, soon to be game developer once again or something. Or maybe a lobbyist. I think she should be a lobbyist. Dwight Silverman, he's a tech burger. I remember when Dwight got out of the tech industry business
for about 20 minutes.
Yeah, he's back, baby.
Back.
And Mike Elgin, he's not traveling. That means we get more of him, our digital nomad at gastronomad.net and, of course, elgin.com. This week, I gave away my Bitcoin wallet.
Previously on Twit.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Who Wants to Be a Bitcoinaire?
What type of animal was seen being dramatic?
Chipmunks are so small. No, it was like this.
How did it do it? Do it again. Do it again. Show me one more time. Oh, yeah, that's it.
Twit events.
Evan A. Barr, this goes back to our conversation about voting. He said we can bank online with security. How is voting more difficult than online banking?
We need voting to be universal, and online banking is not.
Right.
you're extending the security infrastructure of online banking in a universal way. Why can't you do that?
Hands-on photography.
It is part two of our shelter-in-place time-lapse photography and video tutorial.
Oh, that's great.
All about Android.
We talk with Brandon Belinsky, who's the product manager for YouTube Music, about the YouTube Music, Google Play Music integration.
You know, YouTube Music is a great premium audio service. It's ready for Play Music users to come over. And, you know, we launched the one-tap-to-transfer experience that moves all your content over.
Twit. I got your Bitcoin right here.
I should mention, there's one little catch. I'll be glad to send you the wallet file, but I forgot the password. See?
Great. That's just like all of us.
If you can crack it, there is a significant amount of money in there. I'm just saying.
There's more than 7 Bitcoins in there. But so I won't say who won, but it was a really fun contest. You can go, where is it on the feeds? It's on YouTube, right? YouTube.com/twit. You can watch our, this is part of, every Friday now we do Twit After Hours. I hope we keep doing this after this is over because it's so much fun. We've done the match game. We've done Ask Me Anything. We've done trivia. We'd love to have you guys on future ones. We're bringing all sorts of people on. And this time we did Who Wants to Be a Bitcoin Heir? And I gave away my 7-plus Bitcoin wallet. But it's no good to anybody because I don't know the password. I can't remember it for the life of me. But maybe the winner, and I won't say who because I don't want no spoilers, but the person who won it has some significant technical skills. Maybe they can, you know, do a brute force or something. And in a few years, they might be a Bitcoin heir. I don't know.
So, Leo, why don't you do the After Hours show, do a serious, deep computer history trivia game. Ooh. Get Harry McCracken on there. Get me on there.
That's a great
idea. Get some folks who've been around
get
for a long
time. Get some old-timers on.
Yeah, serious. Yeah.
Jerry Pornell's Ghost.
I do it.
Yeah, Jerry Mike, you've been around a while.
Ghost.
Get Jerry Pornell's
Ghost. Yeah, right.
That's a great idea. Done. We will do that. Old-timer tech trivia.
Serious tech trivia.
Serious. Because we did tech trivia in this Who Wants to Be a Bitcoin Heir. But, you know, it wasn't the hardest tech trivia ever. There were some, but, yeah, that's a great idea. Some of the really tough tech trivia. Are you pretty good at that, Dwight? You think you know that?
I think so. It's, you know, let's just put it this way. I used to know a lot of stuff.
Yeah. That's the problem, right?
That's right. That is the problem.
The older the trivia, the more you've forgotten.
Actually, what you should do is get Harry to do the questions because, you know, in terms of, like, Mr. Computer History.
Well, he's been doing some really good pieces at Fast Company. What was his his most recent article? What was it? It was really good. I can't remember, but I'll find it. But he does such a good job, and he does a lot of that computer history. Here's one: how the telephone failed its big test during the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. We'll get some of those questions there. On for the,
there we
for
go. I remember that.
I made the mistake of saying something negative about the TRS-80 on Twitter. He was having my mentions just like
that. Well, okay.
Don't,
to be fair,
don't
that
say trash 80 around.
That was
around
the
Harry.
Computer.
Oh, he's gonna. Oh no, you're
Harry
trouble,
loves
no?
this stuff. That was the computer that if you wore house slippers and slid your feet along the carpet before you sat down on it, you could kill it. You could literally kill it with a static shock. It was like, that's it. I don't work anymore. So there were a few people. Yeah, that's a good idea. Dwight, we'll do that. We do those every Friday, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, our Twit After Hours. It's turned out to be one of the most enjoyable things we do. It's a lot of fun. Let me do one more ad. Then I do want to get to Unreal Engine 5. Because I know you're excited about that, and I am too. In fact, we'll show some of the video that Tim Sweeney unveiled. He said some interesting things about the PS5, including this new PlayStation 5 is so good, PC makers are going to learn a lot about how to make PCs. Very interesting. Our show brought to you by LinkedIn Learning. You know I love LinkedIn Learning. For a long time, we were using lynda.com, and I did all. And I have so many friends who were teachers, experts, they did great classes.
LinkedIn bought them, and they've turned it into LinkedIn Learning, and now it's just grown. It's gotten better and better. The platform is so good for education. 16,000 courses taught by the best in the business, the best industry experts. You can learn skills like how to master working from home. We're all dealing with that. Entrepreneurship foundations, how to be a resilient leader. There are some amazing, 16,000 courses to choose from. I know lots of folks, many of the people you've seen on our shows who are LinkedIn Learning professors, educators. There's also stuff, there's soft skills like 10 ways to stay motivated while job hunting. I sent that one off to my kids. Things like managing in difficult times. Yeah, that's a class. And one of the things I love about LinkedIn Learning, you get custom-tailored course recommendations. You get project files. You get quizzes. They're really interactive. You really get to practice what you learn. It's really learning, and that's why they call it LinkedIn Learning. Courses are available, of course, anytime, anywhere, on your computer, on your phone. You get a certificate when you complete the course, perfect for framing or putting up on your LinkedIn profile. And by the way, we've been doing this for years. We offer LinkedIn Learning to our team because we want them to get skills. We want them to learn new things, to grow, to expand. It's the best way to learn and apply new skills just to grow our business. And because we know when our team members get more skills, it helps us. You'll learn from the best in the business. You'll connect with a global network of experience, and you'll do it on your own time for fun. Get LinkedIn Learning for your team. Keep learning the skills you need to rise to the occasion. Try 1 month free at LinkedInLearning.com/twit. LinkedInLearning.com/twit. That 1 month will be great, too. This is a perfect time. You got a month, I bet. You got a little time on your hands. LinkedInLearning.com/twit. First of all, before I show a video of it, Unreal Engine is used all the time, so many games. It's not just Unreal, right, Brianna?
Right. Well, we have a lot of different engines in the game industry. There's Frostbite, there's Unity. But Unreal in particular is very exciting because it's used beyond the game industry. If you saw the Star Wars movie Solo, you saw Unreal Engine used for a lot of the special effects there. It's just a remarkably agile 3D engine that's really, really good at cinema. So people use it in television pipelines. It's just it's a Swiss Army knife of 3D work.
And I was asking you, how do you work in Unreal Engine? Is it coding?
Well, it's a little bit of everything. You have the Unreal Editor with Unreal 4, and you can install it on a PC or Mac. If you're designing 3D assets, you can bring something in from Maya or Max or Blender and put it in FBX and import it. You can certainly code, or if you don't want to learn to code, you can just use Visual Nodes. They have an entire visual scripting language called Blueprint, which is excellent. Many games that are shipped with Unreal Engine don't have a line of written code in them. It's
really
just people hooking Blueprint nodes together.
No,
it's a
kidding.
Really, it's a very, very, it's a really good language. In fact, with the last game I shipped, I know, C++ really well, but I ended up working in their visual scripting language because it was faster and we were trying to ship a very complicated game on iOS devices. So Unreal Engine is awesome.
Before the show, we were talking about, I was showing you some Minecraft stuff the kids have done. We've got a bunch of 17-year-olds who have their own Minecraft worlds and they're doing a lot of design. And you said, that's the kind of skill, those kids have the kind of skill that they could then go to something like Unreal Engine and design real games.
Absolutely.
That's really interesting. And so there's a whole
generation.
Oh, if anything,
what they're doing is more complicated because they're having to design the static meshes. Like with Unreal Engine, it's just you go into Content Manager and drag the door, the wall, the box, whatever there, and then do the lighting for it. So they're actually doing something that's harder.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And it's free.
Well, it's free to a point. Unreal Engine 5 that's coming out will be free up to $1 million, at which point
you'll
have to pay royalties.
I'll pay royalties after the first million. I'm okay with that.
Well, my last license for Unreal Engine, like if we wanted to put C++ code in it, we had to write Epic a check for, I believe it was $30,000. So this is a much better deal for many people.
That's great. So, yeah. And is Epic Games do this for the money?
Well, what is the Fortnite has become so popular that they've got the money.
Yeah, Tim Sweeney made $7 billion himself last year.
Right, right.
Thanks to Fortnite.
They're really pushing the Epic Store. So there was an announcement this week that Unreal Engine 5 is coming out with just a breathtaking demo, and it got a lot of attention.
Let's take a look. We've got some of that video. Tell me what is the Epic. Instead of GDC, they just did a video. Right. So tell me what is new in this. Is it lighting?
So it is lighting. So if you look at this, look at the number of, we call them tries in the game industry, basically the number of vertexes on all of this. When they get very close, you're not just going to see the lighting. You're going to be able to really, really make out every single point of on these
so
statues.
All of this stuff is really a combination of polygons, often triangles. That's why I call them tries.
So, look at that rock right there.
That looks like, I don't see any triangles. That's amazing. Right.
Well, traditionally in a game, if you looked at something like a rock, we've come up with ways to fake it with normal mapping, which basically puts a 2D image over a 3D object.
Put a texture
on top. Fakes depth.
Yeah.
Well, it fakes depth and makes the engine render it in a way that looks deeper. What they found out how to do here is to render so many tries with this statue that it just looks unbelievably realistic. And the thing that is exciting for game developers like me is rather than having to go through and optimize every single statue to have a low poly, a medium poly, a high poly, an ultra high poly, this new engine is going to do it all dynamically, which has a lot of applications, not just for PlayStation games, but for VFX, for television logos, for everything. So exciting.
I feel like I'm at Petra Jordan. I mean, you could recreate real world stuff. This is...
Yeah.
Truly mind-boggling.
Look at that dynamic lighting. That is so computationally intense.
So that's what they're ridiculous. Doing is moving the light source, and then it figures out what it looks like on each try as it's going through the scene.
That's exactly right. If you look at a video game, you'll notice that shadows and lighting will affect your character, a skeletal mesh, but it's not going to affect the environment around you beyond shadows. So this is a way of doing it. It's dynamic lighting.
Is it ray
tracing? It's much, much deeper. Ray tracing is, if I recall correctly, it's not in this demo yet, but we hope to have that soon.
Because you're starting to get ray tracing now in some hardware.
Right.
Wow.
Look at this. This part is what is absolutely stunning.
And even the person looks pretty darn real. There's always that uncanny valley with the characters in these games.
Right.
For some reason, they can make, rocks. Yeah, I feel like we're in Petra. Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. The number of tries it's computing is just mind-boggling.
What kind of hardware, though? This must be running on a supercomputer, right?
That was my question.
If I remember correctly, this is targeted for the PlayStation 5. So I don't think the video, and you'll look this up, but as I recall, this is something that could run dynamically on a normal PlayStation 5, but it was pre-cooked ahead of time. So it's footage in development from an engine that's in development.
Wow. I've got to buy a PlayStation 5. Will the Xbox Series X, their competitor, both coming out at the end of the year, will that have similar capabilities or?
Well, I imagine Unreal will eventually run on it. The thing I love about Unreal is you can create a game once and then you can port it to Android. You can port it to Mac. You can port it to PC. You can port it to, even Switch in some cases. So it's a very versatile Swiss Army knife.
We've needed this to greatly improve our animation system. Really incredible. And look at the birds and the
predictive foot placement and the lighting.
The lighting is amazing.
IK and body position. Look at the way the scarf is flowing. It's older technology, but that's physics on that particular scarf and the way the bone structure inside of it is floating around.
So
if you think about the
calculations involved are phenomenal.
Well, they figured out how to optimize it. But, something like this just could not be done on a PlayStation 4. It would be impossible.
If you read the Carmack's book about the early days of id, the techniques that he had to use to make Doom even vaguely playable, there was a lot of trickery involved.
Yep.
And that was partly because the processors weren't that good. But I think that there is still algorithmically a lot of magic going on here.
Yeah. What's exciting about this for developers is if I was trying to do something like this in Unreal Engine 4, I would have to spend a week on every one of these statues. I would have to go into ZBrush with that particular shield and create custom normals and spectral maps. What they've focused on is the pipeline here for developers. So I would be able to take that high poly asset directly from ZBrush, bring it into Unreal Engine, and then like your kid making a Minecraft level, just drag and drop that into the scene. And then it would do that. This is what they're saying, that it will do all that work for me beneath the hood. So
is it just ZBrush? Will it work with Blender or other 3D?
Yeah, it would work with other 3D programs, but something this detailed is done in ZBrush. So yeah, if what they're saying is true, this is going to really cut down on the amount of time it takes games to create things that are visually stunning.
Right. And you can see why Epic is doing this, because these games will probably be on the Epic. A lot of them will be on the Epic platform. They sell them.
Correct.
They have an Epic store. They just want, a Fortnite every year is all we ask.
Which is funny, because Fortnite is very low poly.
I know. It's not interesting, isn't it? It's not challenging. Was that an aesthetic decision, or is that a decision based on the fact you're going to have a lot of players, a lot of things to calculate?
I mean, you try and make games like that for a wide, wide, wide audience. Like World of Warcraft is like that as well.
Yes, of course.
Wow, this is just stunning stuff.
But that's one advantage of having a platform like the PlayStation 5 that's so dominant.
Yep.
That you can say, well, I know there's going to be a million players out of the box ready to buy my game.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, after looking at this, I can't wait to get one. Will it look like this out of the... I mean, it's not even out yet, right?
Well, the one thing is, if you talk to Amazon about, their lumberyard technology, they will swear up and down that it's great, it's amazing. I mean, the company is going to tell you their product is great.
Everybody can do this.
Right. I want to see developers look at this and evaluate the pipeline. I certainly will when I can get my hands on it. But, Epic, I can say this. I've worked with them a lot. They've always been a very honest company with me. Their support has always been excellent. And they're a very developer-focused company. So from my experience, I have no reason not to believe what they're saying is true.
Just to be clear, is this pre-rendered, or, in other words, is it like a cutscene? They kept saying interactive. It looks like it's being played.
Right. It would be something like that would be done on the fly in the game. Even cutscenes are not pre-baked. I mean, nowadays they're being rendered in the engine. It's just playing straight through.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Generally, yeah.
They don't render them ahead of time to make them look better, huh?
They do some of them, but generally speaking, most cutscenes and games are using the engine dynamically,
Is this the best engine out there now?
I think we'll have to look at it and tell, but I've spent my career learning Unreal Engine, so I feel very strongly about it.
We're going to, it's just in the nick of time when we get the second wave of quarantine in place for the year 2021, we'll have a great game machine to play with it. Was that Tomb Raider, or is it just kind of a random?
Just a random new IP that they were playing with.
Wow, really interesting. Guys, Dwight, you don't play video games, do you? Are you a big Fortnite player?
No, I did a long time ago. I was kind of a big Doom, Quake.
Yeah, me too.
I don't have the time to do that anymore. And now I would get, my butt handed to me. My handle was the Llama King, which should tell you how bad I was.
You really kicked the llama's butt, did you?
The other way around.
So I played a lot of Unreal when it first came out, that was 20 years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That looked amazing for its time.
It was mind-boggling. Yeah. I remember.
So NASA uses Unreal to develop training for astronauts. I did a story about virtual reality at NASA several years ago. And one of the things they have a lab where they essentially train astronauts what to do if they get in trouble on a spacewalk. And I got to use their simulator with VR, where I was essentially standing out on the edge of the arm on the space station, the robotic arm.
Oh, that's cool.
And it was incredible. And they use Unreal. Some of the other simulations use Unity, but it was incredibly impressive.
Yeah. The thing I like about Unreal is the Cinemag scripting part of it. Like, if you're looking to do Cinemag scripting, they've just they really invented the interactive cutscene in 3D in games in a way that was very accessible for developers. So they've literally been working on that part of the engine since 1998, and they've gotten to be very good at it.
Yeah, 98. I remember on the Screensavers set, we built what we called at the time the ultimate gaming machine, which had a CRT monitor that was like 800 pounds. And it was a widescreen monitor, which in those days was probably this. But we played a lot of Unreal, and it blew my mind then, because I had played Doom, which was, go back and look at the original Doom, pretty gritty. And then Quake, we loved Quake. And then Unreal came out, and it was like, this, how are they doing this? It's amazing. Let's take a little break. Mike, do you want to talk about gaming? I left you out.
No.
Okay.
I'm a workaholic, Leo. I don't play games at all.
No, I know. But I love games. I've been a gamer my whole life, but I don't have the time or the patience anymore.
That's the problem.
It takes a lot of devotion, especially now with these young kids. You go and you start Call of Duty and you're dead. I played Fortnite. I loved it, but I died. I was like, there's 100 people go in, Leo goes out. It's like it was over before it even began. So,
can I say, though, that's not your fault. That's the game industry's fault. In the last 10 years, we've shifted towards a game design that is it is designed to bring you in for massive amounts of time,
right,
to give you a huge learning curve and to keep you hooked as long as possible. I love games that you can go beat in 5 to 10 hours, and we just don't ship those anymore. So that's not your fault, Leo and Mike. That's,
the last game I loved industry. And finished, I think, was BioShock Infinite.
Yeah,
And you could finish that in a reasonable amount of time. And I also loved but did not finish Skyrim. Because those are such vivid worlds, and they were unique and interesting worlds. They were more, it was more than just how many kills can you rack up in 5 minutes? There was really a story, and there was, you'd go around a corner and something interesting was happening. And I would love to see more games like that. I remember thinking when BioShock Infinite came out, well, that's that.
that's Unreal Engine, by the way.
Is BioShock it? Infinite. Yeah. Yep. Amazing, isn't it? I look at Unreal Engine, I think we're going to see a lot of things besides games coming out of this. So, as you said, NASA and, I could see travel. I could see all sorts of interesting uses.
Hollywood.
Yeah. Yeah.
Military uses it for training, for safety training. So.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Deepfake videos, political propaganda.
Just think. Yeah. Just think what you could do with it. Our show today brought to you by Extra Hop. Just think what you could do with Extra Hop. With more and more companies going remote, the cyber criminals are out there. They're ready to take advantage of the changing IT reality. More important than ever for organizations to know what's going on in their enterprise. And I don't just mean your local area network or even your wide area network. I mean your cloud. I mean IoT devices. Employees are at home. Remember when somebody brought a Raspberry Pi into NASA and it brought the whole thing down? Now, it's the opposite. You're bringing NASA to your Raspberry Pi. You're in people's houses. That's why you need ExtraHop in order to protect and scale your business, because that's how ExtraHop started, with performance monitoring. You need more than just visibility. You need fast, reliable information about threats, about remote access problems. And when you get that information, you need it in the context that helps you act and fix the problem right away. That's ExtraHop. It helps you detect threats and performance issues up to 95% faster and respond 60% more efficiently. You're going to get complete visibility on every asset in your enterprise, and that's in real time. In fact, go to the ExtraHop site, extrahop.com/twit, and take a look at the dashboard. They have a demo dashboard. You will be blown away. You'll say, how do I get this? I want this now. I want to see every asset in real time at scale now. You can secure your hybrid enterprise wherever it is today, wherever it goes tomorrow. Automatically detect new rogue and unmanaged IoT devices. See everything in your environment from the cloud to the data center all the way down to the customer. ExtraHop is awesome. It keeps your business safe and available at any scale. Look at that. Wizards of the Coast, they use ExtraHop. They use it to support and secure their AWS cloud. At Wizards of the Coast chief architect Dan McDaniel said, there's no other company that aligns to supporting our DevOps model, the speed, the lack of friction, than ExtraHop. He loves it. The Home Depot uses it. Now, Home Depot's got 2,300 remote sites. They've got point of sale. They've got a massive security challenge. They use ExtraHop to manage and secure those remote sites. And this is the quote, no data set is more complete and accurate than what ExtraHop delivers. If you need that information, if you need the threat detection, if you have performance issues, if you are anxious to respond quickly to anything happening to your network, you can take control of your cloud and your cloud security right now with ExtraHop. Get tips on securing and supporting remote access. And then, honestly, you got to, it is so cool. Check out the full product demo at extrahop.com/twit. But I got to warn you, as soon as you see it, you're going to say, why don't we have this? extrahop.com/twit. These guys are great. Great product. And, you know, in a way, this show has really been all about how cool technology is and how cool it's getting. And I think so many times we get jaded and complacent. And we go, oh, it's all a mess. There is amazing stuff going on out there. And the kind of visualizations you can get with ExtraHop, that's a perfect example. I almost want to just, let's talk about good stuff. Let's make this the positive episode of Twit. We've had enough negative episodes of Twit. I want to talk about the good things, like the University of California college graduation that in Minecraft that they built. That's awesome. That's awesome. I think a lot of companies are saying Twitter just announced they're going to let employees work at home forever. Employees love it.
It sounds like they're expanding the hours that they expect people to work.
Oh, you cynical
never
person.
Never stop working, ever. You know, it's kind of funny because I've been advocating remote work for decades, 20 years.
That's
now,
what you do. Basically. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And there's always been this resistance. Oh, it can't be done, can't be done. And now everybody's doing it and people are saying, hey, you know, that really could have been an email. This is like totally working. That's one of the reasons why I've been so anti-Zoom, because Zoom is kind of taking away some of the benefits of remote work, which is that you can focus, you can control your environment to a certain extent. But once people are actually working remotely without their kids being at home and schools canceled and without all these Zoom meetings all day, it's going to really enhance productivity. The other thing that I think is really interesting for this show is that a lot of people in Silicon Valley are saying, why are we here paying these prices?
Right.
Dealing with this traffic.
They don't have to.
If we're going to be from home, our home could be anywhere. And so why don't we go live in a cabin? Why don't we go live abroad? Why don't we live in a small town? And this is really, I think, going to change the dynamics of cities. Probably not great for the cities, but probably great for the lifestyle that people, especially people lucky enough to work in tech and other kinds of industries where you can work remotely, work. And I think it's going to be a massive transformation. It's really an accelerant of a trend that was already inevitable. I think we've just leapt forward 10 years in terms of how many people are going to be working from home.
I have a different opinion on this. You know, after Gamergate, I worked with Twitter quite a bit to update their policies and to figure out what happened and to stop things like that from happening again. And when I've gone to Twitter and I've seen in person the kinds of alliances and friendships that people have as they've tried to navigate this giant corporation with a lot of different competing departments with different goals, I've seen firsthand the value of being able to bring someone down to the cafeteria to hang out and to talk to someone about a point of view that they hadn't considered. And I think even if you widen that out from just Twitter, I do think that in person has value. Does that mean that every single company moving forward needs to spend a huge amount of money paying for San Francisco real estate? No, of course not. But I do think that there's something that gets lost when you move to 100% virtual, especially in engineering teams.
If you talk to Matt Mullenweg, who is the founder of WordPress, runs parent company is Automattic. He has a podcast called Distributed, and he's kind of a big evangelist for distributed work. He will tell you that you do need to have in-person gatherings. Automattic does an annual all-hands meeting, but they don't have to meet at their headquarters. They don't have a headquarters. They meet at whatever cool location in the world they want to go to.
Ooh, that's cool.
But for them, that's important, and I agree with Brianna. I think what we'll see is maybe a kind of a hybrid thing that will happen. I mean, I can see here at the Chronicle, you know, we are all working remotely. I can see us maybe not necessarily always coming back to the newsroom every day, but maybe a couple of times a week we're in the newsroom. And I think that I think you're going to see kind of a combination.
It's always been. Go ahead, Mike.
You also have to consider the fact that working from home is really something that is or is not amenable to your personality. So those, right. You know, some of us are self-driven introverts who are self-directed and we need time to think and we need control over our own thought process. Lots of other people get a lot more energy and ideas from being around other people and interacting and so on. And so I think the best case scenario is that the work from home situation reflects not just some blanket company policy, but actually reflects the preferences of individual personalities so that the people who really thrive working from home can do so. And the people who really thrive in an office environment can do that. One ironic slow-moving catastrophe is that several major Silicon Valley companies, specifically Facebook, but also Google, just invested gazillions of dollars in these massive open office plans. Facebook in particular has the world's largest open office in Menlo Park. And just as soon as they had that up and running for a year or two, along comes a virus that is spreads like wildfire in an open office. Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of an ironic thing that companies are going to have to deal with. Even those Silicon Valley companies and elsewhere, they're going to have to figure out how to sort of wall people off to a certain extent because Facebook-like open offices are not going to fly in a world of global pandemics.
Microsoft used to always have offices, right? I don't think Microsoft embraced open offices unless they have more recently.
Yeah.
But all the new guys, I mean, look at Apple's campus, you know, that's all open. And I do agree with you, Brianna, that I feel like, for instance, Twitter is a really good example. The Twitter was in the South Park of San Francisco, and a bunch of startups started up around that because they would see each other, they'd run into each other, they'd have lunch together, and there was this collegial aspect that was one of the reasons San Francisco had such a great startup scene, is because everybody was there, and there is something to be said for that. Steve Jobs famously in the new Apple campus, in the initial design, only had one bathroom per floor. So, because he wanted people to all kind of run into each other as they walked a mile and a half to get to the bathroom.
I hope they didn't have an open office plan inside the bathroom.
Yeah, right.
I think they better, saner minds talked him out of it. But initially, he really wanted, like, we don't want so many bathrooms. That's typical Steve, right? Here's the guy who used to wash his feet in the toilet. So, who knows what Steve was thinking.
Like Twitter that is really, they've had some tough problems, right? Like, Gamergate happened at Twitter because, let's just really be honest here, it was a bunch of white dudes that designed it, and they didn't think about harassment and didn't invest in trust and safety. And they had to have hard conversations and redo features, and they tried slapping Band-Aids on it. And I can tell you for a fact, there are people at Twitter that put everything on the line to improve it. And Twitter today is a drastically better product today than it was during Gamergate. I'm unsure how effective that advocacy could have been in an all work from home situation. Maybe it could have. I don't know. My husband's work, you know, he does patent law for a living. His job is barely affected. In fact, it's easier for him to write patents without all the meetings. Sure. But sure. I could see it working better for a company that's more static in what they produce or that's smaller. But when you get to the size of a big company, you invariably have people with competing goals, different agendas, different cultures. And I think some of that clash has to happen in person.
Yeah. So do you think, going back to our original conversation, that these virtual reality glasses and the 3D mapped skeletal frame would help that, or is it not enough? It would.
No, I do. There was back before I decided to run for office, there was a VR tech I was looking at. They had eye tracking with it. So for the skeletal mesh, I would look at, if I was looking over here and you look at it, then the eyes would turn and look you dead in the eye. It was such a emotionally connective effect.
Yes. Yes.
That it produced something. So I do think it could have very good. I think it could help build that human connection.
How interesting. Yeah. In fact, Twitter itself said that one of the reasons, you know, they were able to get out of their fail whale situation was that their engineers would talk to other engineers at other startups in the area that were trying to figure out how to scale. And the information shared that way actually helped them become a more scalable product. So there's a lot to be said for collegiality. But unfortunately, most of us in the computer industry are introverts and very happy at home writing up our patents. One last story. I want this it's from the Stuff May Hear YouTube channel. It is Shane Whiten's robotic basketball hoop. This is what happens when nerds are locked in the house for a lengthy period of time. If you can't shoot hoops, well, you could get a Raspberry Pi to make sure that every single basket goes in. Thank you, Shane.
Love this.
This is what I need, for sure. Mike Elgin, I'm sorry that you're stuck in the United States, but I guess you're having a good time with Princess Squishy Face and the fam.
Quick thing, you said you wanted to talk about positive things. This is we've been fermenting everything. Wow, this is blurry.
Got the Skype blur on. That's why it can only your nose is in focus.
Okay, so this is actually something my wife just made. This is tepache. This is fermented pineapple rind.
Oh,
so this is actually an Aztec drink. They used to make it with corn, and when the Spanish started bringing in pineapples to Mexico, they started making it with pineapple. But it's pineapple rind with water and piloncillo. You let it sit around for a week or two, and it becomes this delicious alcoholic beverage.
OMG.
Yeah, it's so good. So try it. If you're going to cut open a pineapple, just take the peel, just throw it in a jar, put some water in there and some sugar, and it will ferment on its own using the microbes that are on the pineapple.
I think we're all learning how important fermentation is.
Yes.
Ferment all the things. I've got my little sourdough starter. It's bubbling away. This is the COVID-19 fermentation class.
Fermentation
is
life.
It is.
Somebody mentioned that it was like a conspiracy among the microbes. It was COVID-19. The coronavirus was there to get us all to use these other microbes.
I love that. So you put the pineapple rind in there with some sugar. She's using what? Some special sugar.
Piloncillo, the Mexican sugar. And you could also use brown sugar.
Unrefined sugar she's using. But exactly. And then how long does it take to ferment?
Anywhere between probably 3 or 4 days to, I don't know, a couple of weeks. She did this for 3 weeks. If you keep going, it becomes something that they call in Central America, they call it chiche, which is a highly alcoholic. This still has some sugar in it, so it's still sweet.
Yeah.
So if you let the fermentation devour all that sugar, it's going to convert that into alcohol, and you're going to have a drinking problem. So,
or an opportunity. Options.
That's the beauty of fermentation. I can quit anytime.
And right. It won't, but you could.
Thank you, Mike Elgin. Elgin.com is his website. Subscribe to his newsletter, full of wild and fun stuff. Yes. I love the things you're finding at Mike Elgin on Twitter. It's always a pleasure to see you. And give my love to Kevin and the gang and
Princess
Squishy Face and Amira. And miss you all. I'll tell you what, if there's one group miss of people too. I'd want to hang out with right now, it'd be you guys.
Thank you.
The living and easy. Yeah. Dwight Silverman, he is at the Houston Chronicle, at the Tech Burger, HoustonChronicle.com/TechBurger. What else are you doing these days?
Well, I have a newsletter that I launched. I think I just launched it when
you did.
I think I was last on.
Yep.
It's called Release Notes. It's every Monday morning. You can get it at HoustonChronicle.com/release notes. And it is the most in newsletter world, what you want to do is you want to have your newsletters be opened in the email rather than just sit as a header. And I'm really happy that Release Notes is the most opened newsletter at the Chronicle.
Nice.
So, yes. Yeah, I'm really pleased with that. And in fact, I finished it just while I was waiting to connect to you guys. I was finally finishing it. I had rushed over here and I had like two more stories to write. And so I did them while I wasn't able to connect to you.
Perfect.
So I appreciate the delay.
Yes, perfect. You see, you're so efficient. We don't need to go to work. We could just, we'll do it all from home.
That's right.
Brianna Wu's got a new toy. I know she's anxious to get to her 14-core. How many cores?
14-core iMac.
14-core.
I got that. So CDW is canceling. They have corporate customers. They're canceling tons of orders. I have a friend of mine that works with them. So that machine, if you bought that new from Apple, that would cost you about $7,500. I got it for $5,800, believe it or not.
You're going to love it. My main machine is a John, I put up the CDW site because I was hoping she was going to say you could buy it, but it turns out she has a friend.
I have a friend. Yes.
John saying, let's see, where is it? I want to, but I love my iMac Pro. That is my go-to machine. And I know they have a newer Mac Pro with more cores and more power and stuff. Mm-hmm. That iMac Pro is very, very sweet machine. And I have two cinema displays running off it. So it's a three. The only thing I'm very jealous because Lisa has the biggest freaking monitor I've ever seen. It's like a, the arm span. It's like a six. It's like 57-inch curved. It's crazy. The thing is, because I have an iMac, I can't really do that. And I kind of almost wish I could. But I do love that iMac. It's a beautiful.
So you have two of the Thunderbolt displays, the old 24-inch Apple.
Yeah. So one of them's Thunderbolt and one of them's DisplayPort, or maybe Thunderbolt 2. I can't remember. Right. Yeah, I had to get
is
an adapter.
Is it the ACD? Yeah.
Yeah, I had to get an adapter. I'll send you the way it worked. But yeah, you can. Yeah, it's three Apple. It's iMac plus two Apple displays, and it's great.
That's good. I have two
yes,
of those.
You just need the adapters.
Out how to plug it in? Yeah.
Yeah, and what I think I ended up doing from Otherworld Computing, they make a docks because I needed one extra display port or something like that, and then I was able to do it, and I've been doing that, and it's great. It's really nice to have that real estate. But
I was worried the Vegas 64 wouldn't drive a second monitor with a good frame rate.
Yeah, it looks good. That's got a lot of oomph. Oomph. Thank you, Brianna. I'm really sorry that you're not going to be in Congress in January. I'm really sad. About
I am
that.
Too. It's but hard giving up a dream.
Maybe you'll be there lobbying for us. That would be a good thing. And I would certainly contribute to a political action committee that was run by Brianna Wu. That's for sure.
I could take some time. I could play some video games. I could get to know my husband, again, who I've not spent too much time with in the last couple of years. And nice we're going to take it from there.
Get some time together.
I need some time to reground myself.
I think, and by the way, inspired by you, our next show we'll be doing Round the Campfire in Red Dead Redemption. I think that sounds like a great great way to do a show. We do. Wouldn't that be fun?
Totally.
Mike could bring the red eye.
Yeah.
Yeah. We do this show every Sunday afternoon, around 2:30 Pacific, 5:30 Eastern, 21:30 UTC. If you want to participate, watch live, chat along with the show, the first thing to do is go to the live stream, audio or video, at twit.tv/live, and then go into the chat room at irc.twit.tv. You can use your web browser or an IRC client. Great bunch of people. They're there all week long. So if you get lonely in your quarantine, and you wish you had some geeks to hang out with any time of the day or night, there's always somebody at irc.twit.tv. If you can't be here live, of course, because we are a Netcast. You can get the show at our website. All right, it's a podcast. Twit.tv. All of our shows are there. Download them on demand. And the other thing you could do is use a podcast player and subscribe. That way you'll get it the minute it's available, and that would help us too. Thank you, everybody. Stay safe. Stay well. We'll see you next week. Another Twit.
It's amazing. In the can. Bye-bye.